You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up on our summer music series set list, we'll feature the Milwaukee rap group Automatic.
First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. On Wednesday, a federal appeals court blocked a lower court's order that would have eased Wisconsin's voter ID law for the general election in November. The court order would have allowed voters without legally approved photo IDs to vote by signing an affidavit saying they faced a, quote, reasonable impediment to getting one of those IDs.
And yesterday, another judge, another case, another stay on a voter ID ruling. Robert Mentzer joins us now for this and other top stories from around the state this week. He's a storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back.
Hey, thanks.
Well, before we get to voter ID, Rob, some breaking news this afternoon. Brendan Dassey, who was convicted along with his uncle Stephen Avery in the murder of Teresa Halbach, Dassey has won a court order that could result in his getting a new trial or being freed from prison. Now, this is one of the people profiled in that Netflix documentary series, Making a Murderer, that got a lot of attention around the country. Rob, what do we know about this?
Yes, this is just breaking, just within the last 30 minutes or so. A federal judge has given prosecutors 90 days to decide whether or not Dassey can get a new trial, and had some fairly harsh words for prosecutors, said that their investigators' false promises to Dassey and their treatment of him during the interrogations, especially given that he was 16 years old at the time and had some mental deficits, the judge says that this became an involuntary confession under the 5th and 14th Amendments. And so, I mean, yeah, there's a likelihood that this will be appealed, but it certainly opens the door to a new trial for Dassey.
So we'll be watching for more details on that and what happens in that 90-day span. So turning to another court case, two other court cases, actually, Rob, Wisconsin's voter ID law. So earlier this week, a federal court granted a stay on this voter ID ruling from a federal judge in Wisconsin. So what happened?
Well, so I'm trying to come up with the right metaphor for this. Is it like the end of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, where the killer keeps coming back? Is it like a bad penny? Yeah. It's 30 years old. What is at issue with the voter ID law, which has been challenged and blocked and brought back in and blocked and brought back in, at this point is not the voter ID itself. Having to show an ID at the polls has been found to be legal. Maybe it's a good policy, maybe it's a bad policy, but that requirement is not the issue anymore. The issue now is about the ID. You can't charge someone to vote, and so that means the state has an obligation to provide free IDs to people who don't have one. And so the back and forth this week has been about whether or not to allow people to sign an affidavit and say, I don't have one and it would be hard for me to get one. A federal judge found that, or a federal panel of judges found that that a lower judge hadn't considered the actual, whether it was actually true, and so threw that out. But that's really the issue, is how hard or easy is it for people in the state to get the free state ID that they need to vote?
That's one case making its way through the courts. There's also another one that covered wider election laws, just including voter ID, and the judge in that case issued a stay yesterday on his ruling, and this has to do with provisions from the state for people who have trouble getting IDs. A long, complicated story, but it sounds like, correct me if I'm wrong, Rob, everything is in place for the November election in the way that the state's voter ID law was passed, pretty much, at this point, right?
Right, that's right. That's exactly right, at this point, yes.
So bring your ID to the polls if you want to vote. Get that ID now, I guess, is the lesson for voters there, and we'll keep watching those courts. What do we expect, higher court rulings now on these two rulings anytime soon?
Not anytime soon. I wouldn't expect that. I think that it's at this point the higher court would be a 4-4 Supreme Court anyway.
Talking to Rob Mentzer from USA Today Network, Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau. Looking at the top stories in Wisconsin this week, Rob, a lot of people have been watching for the new Marquette Law School poll this week. They're looking for presidential polling data in Wisconsin. big lead, double-digit lead, depending on how you slice it, anywhere from 10 to 15 points for Hillary Clinton over Donald Trump. A lot of people surprised by the extent of that lead. What did you make of it?
Love the Marquette Law School poll. Always, it has a good track record, and it always is a treasure trove of information. So indeed, it's a big lead, and it shows Hillary Clinton pulling away. The usual disclaimers apply, right? It's a moment in time. This comes after the Democratic National Convention and Donald Trump's very, very rough political week. So this might be, this might represent about as big as a gap as you would expect. But it's a huge gap, right? Especially when you add those likely voter screens. The difference is 52% Clinton to 37% Trump among likely voters. That's tricky to determine at this point, to this far away from the election, but the way to really understand that is a measure that shows that Wisconsin Republicans are just not that excited about getting out to vote for Donald Trump.
Now, Mike Pence was just here. Donald Trump has another visitor too expected in the very near future, so apparently they're not looking at these poll results and giving up on Wisconsin.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Wisconsin is part of the sort of upper Midwest region that is important to Trump if he is to win the White House. So we hear a lot about Pennsylvania and Michigan, but Wisconsin is right in there. I think that it's probably significant that Pence has come to, he was in Milwaukee this week, and that's in particular, so the suburban Milwaukee, of course, is like a Republican stronghold and a place where Republicans need to really run up the vote if they're going to win anything statewide. And suburban Milwaukee is also a place that the Marquette poll demonstrated Donald Trump is extremely unpopular. So, you can sort of glimpse a little bit of strategy there in sending Mike Pence there to try to make the case for his guy and say, like, hey, you guys are conservatives, you should really vote for the Republican here.
And another big election people around the country are watching here in Wisconsin, the Senate race, Ron Johnson and Russ Feingold. What did we see in the polls there?
So, short version, Feingold is at 49% and Johnson at 43% among registered voters. Among likely voters, Feingold is up to 53% and Johnson to 42%. So 11 points. That's the biggest gap that we've seen in this race. In July, it was likely voters, it was 46% Feingold to 40% Johnson. So yeah, I mean that's in a way that may be partly a demonstration of that might be a Trump effect, especially among likely voters. If Republicans are less likely to get to the polls, that hurts Ron Johnson and it hurts other Republican candidates on the ticket.
Again, a moment in time, Rob. But as we start to wrap up, what are you looking for to see if either party still considers Wisconsin a battleground state in the Senate and presidential election?
Sure. Well, okay. So campaign visits certainly are a sign that the campaigns are seeking to compete. But also, you got to look at ad buys, right? That is there haven't been a lot, to be honest. And so it will. That's a major decision in any campaign where to spend your resources, particularly particularly on the airwaves. And if the state is not that close, we may not see as many of those as we have the last couple cycles.
Well, Rob, thanks as always for being with us today.
All right, thank you.
That's Robert Mentzer. He's a storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. He joins us every Friday afternoon to talk about some of the top state news stories that happened over the past week.
We continue our summer music series set list. Today we feature the Milwaukee rap group Automatic. They recently stopped by WPR to perform in our studio.
The group's frontman, Darius Windham, spoke with our own Maureen McCollum about the experience of rapping for the first time in front of an audience and how the feel of a song can be more important than the actual sound we hear.
.3099 and Automatic came about at the same time. I used to be in a group called Classic, and once we disbanded Classic, Trail approached me about like starting up a group, and then we formed Automatic. But my plan was, before working on an Automatic album, was to do an experimental album under the name 3099. That didn't work because Automatic had sort of taken off, and so 3099 kind of got forgotten about, I suppose.
So with 3099, it's you and DJ JDL Rockwell?
Yeah, JDL Rockwell. Okay. Yeah, I write all of the lyrics. And then as far as how the music comes together, sometimes like he'll have like a skeleton of a beat, and then, you know, I'll listen to it and I'll write to it, and then I'll be like, okay, well, perhaps like I should play some keys here, or get a guy to like play a bass line, or I should get someone to do the drums or something like that. And mm-hmm. we just kind of put it together like that. Or maybe I'll start out and I'll have like some keys or something like that, and he'll add like some drums to it, and then we'll just kind of build on it like that. Everything that we do, it pretty much happens organically. It can be like, you know, we finish each other's thoughts pretty much when it comes to music. You can't fathom the passion I have when I had a bit of bad in my hands. I am the juggernaut running the brick walls low key. I'm the Hulk slamming low key on dope beats. Nothing to fear but fear itself. With that being said, I'm fearless. Nobody really knows what they want to hear till they're hearing it. So just listen, just experience.
And what's interesting about this project is it sounds so different from some of the work that you've put together with Automatic itself. Like, Automatic, it sounds like some of the older hip-hop that we heard, you know, more commonly maybe 20 years ago or so. And yeah. This sounds, I don't know. I don't know how you would put words to how it sounds. How
it's
do you
weird,
describe
right?
it? Like, yeah, I like it, though. It's fun.
Yeah, okay. So, well, as far as Automatic is concerned, we grew up listening to music in the 90s, and that music made us feel a certain way. And when it comes to Automatic and, you know, JDL and I working on 3099, sound is not as important as a feel. You know what I mean? Like, the reason why, like, a lot of people, like, give us the 90s comparison is because, like, it feels genuinely like 90s music. It may not sound all the way like 90s, but the spirit and the feel of it is there. JDL and I grew up listening to, like, a lot of new wave and different rock influences, you know, house. And, you know, we wanted to take those influences and try to, like, recreate it. But it's all about making music that's relatable to everyone, you know. Like, people go through times of, like, feeling self-doubt, being in love, being out of love, and that's what I try to write about.
The first song in the album, as I was listening to it, it almost sounds like you're questioning your musical path and just stress about the future. Is that what you were trying to communicate?
Yes. It was like something that I did not ask for. I was a pretty good basketball player back in the day, and that was what I decided was going to be my path. My plan was to be a 6'5 shooting guard, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
And yeah, so I stopped growing when I reached like 5'9½. So like my plan kind of changed. But as far as like music is concerned, like, one of my older cousins, like, he used to rap back in the day, and, like, you know, he was my idol. So, you know, I wanted to be like him because I didn't have any older brothers or anything like that. So there was this one time we were at my grandmother's, and I was asking him if, like, you know, I could rap with him. So, like, he was like, oh, okay, I'll kick it off, and then we'll see, you know, what's up. So he started, and then he passed it to me, and things started moving in slow motion. I could not hear anything. All I could do is see their faces looking like, oh my God, this whatever I was saying must have been absolutely amazing, because like when I stopped, they just looked like mouths just dropped, and they were like, yo, oh my God, that was so amazing.
Oh,
and
that's
I'm like,
great.
So it was just like from there, you know, I kind of felt like it was a gift. But at the same time, like to be the type of artist that I am, like it comes with certain sacrifices, like being in a healthy relationship. I can't really do it. Being able to like be around friends and family a whole lot, sometimes going few and far in between, because like I'm always in the studio or I'm always like, you know, somewhere performing. And then like from the financial standpoint, I currently work 3 jobs to support this music. I'm not an independent artist. This is starving artistry. Like, I basically have to make decisions like, okay, am I going to pay this cable bill or am I going to get this mixed and mastered? You know what I'm saying? Like,
right.
I have to make, like, sacrifices that a lot of people aren't aware of. All those, like, frustrations, all those doubts and everything, that's what went into Ostinato. I could fall on either side, yo. Or maybe I need to swallow my pride, yo, and cut this BS and get a steady 9-to-5, yo. The industry don't seem like it's really fond of my kind, yo. Maybe that's the reason why I've yet to be signed, yo. Or maybe I'm asking the wrong questions. Maybe I'm mediocre with a crew full of yes men. Maybe my biological can see into the future and he knew I'd be a failure. That's why he made his exit. I feel like life is, like, you know, a lot of people say life is too short. But I feel like life is very long, and life is extremely long when you're doing something that you don't love. And, you know, I just want to get to the point where I'm able to support myself by doing what I love. It's really crazy, too. Like, a lot of people, they come up to me after shows and whatnot, and they're like, dude, how come you're not signed?
Do you want to be signed?
I want to be signed to, like, maybe an independent label.
Sure.
That would probably, like, allow us to be able to, you know, do more shows nationally and internationally. I don't want to be, like, on a major label and be, like, super famous. I'd like to be rich. I want to get
comfortable,
to
go on some vacations. But
yeah, like, to whereas I can be like, oh, really? It's supposed to be 30 in Milwaukee. Let's go.
I'm out of here.
Yeah. Like that type of thing.
Yeah.
But to me, like, music is like the quality and the integrity of the music is most important to me. Strong enough to endure the pain a day longer. I reminisce on when hip hop saved my life. If I could relive that moment, would I decline the offer?
Maybe. I don't know. In Ostinato, you talk about reminiscing on the moment hip hop saved your life. Was that the moment when you jumped up on stage with your cousin?
No. That was actually about something a little more personal.
Okay.
When I was like 14, 15, I was under, like, you know, bad influences and whatnot. And I was feeling like I was in dire straits, you know, like. My mom is like my best friend, and like, you know, we had been like butting heads and things like that, and basically, like, I kind of felt like I didn't belong here. I felt like I was way more trouble than like anybody intended. And so, like, I was thinking that the best way that I could take care of it was to end my life. I actually was, like, set up, and, like, I was listening to music, and I was gonna do it. Well, this song by Outkast called Mainstream came on. For some reason, the words in that song spoke to me, and it just kept me from ending my life, basically. Mm. So
I'm so glad you heard that song in that moment.
Yeah, it was crazy, but from that moment on, I felt like I owed music my life. This is my calling. This is what I'm supposed to be doing. And, you know, I want to make sure that, you know, I put out respectable music. Like, the thing with Automatic, like, the way that we create music, like, it's 98% clean. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, we can seamlessly do shows at an elementary school to, like, adult venues, like, without changing anything. You know what I mean? And like, And to do that in a way that, like, we're not corny, like, it's not the Wiggles, you know what I mean?
Sure.
Like, you know what I mean? Or something like that, you know what I mean? Like, we're like, making music that, like, anybody can listen to. Like, that's really important.
They say it make you want to do right. Some say it make you want to do wrong. Inspire some to create a life. Inspire me to want to write a song.
And I started thinking about, like, some of the people that I had been around and, you know, like, their negative views and their pessimism and stuff like that. And it was like, it takes the same amount of energy to be negative and pessimistic as it would to be positive and optimistic. So, like, I felt like my life already was terrible as I saw it. So I figured, like, if I flip the switch and I try to be positive and optimistic, you know, what would it hurt? And so, like, a month and a half after having that type of view, things started looking up. I have a saying, like, all things are possible through faith and the power of positive thinking. I say that 5 times a day. I pray 5 times a day. And, you know, even when I'm in the most dire straits, you know, like, I keep it going.
Now, as the beat breaks down, y'all, I want y'all to feel the love. I want y'all to feel the love. I want y'all to feel the love. Yeah. Love is complex. Who said it's gotta be simple? I think we get it.
That was Darius Windham of the Milwaukee rap group Automatic, talking to our own Maureen McCollum.
Setlist Summer Music Series airs every Friday at this time until Labor Day weekend. Support for Setlist comes from Hyde Music. For more about the artists featured on Setlist, including songs and videos of their exclusive performances at our WPR studio, head over to WPR.org/setlist.
Hey, yo, we talking about love. Hey, yo, we talking about love. I said we talking about love. Hey, yo, we talking about love.
If you've ever found yourself frustrated by the speed of your internet, either at home or at work, well, you are not alone. According to a recent report from the technology firm Speedtest, Wisconsin lags behind the rest of the nation when it comes to internet speeds, ranking 49th among states and the District of Columbia.
In addition to slow speeds, there are also parts of the state where just getting broadband is a challenge, if not impossible. Because of all this, some say Wisconsin is falling behind economically.
Barry Orton joins us now. He's an emeritus professor of telecommunications at UW-Madison. He's also the chairman of the Madison Citywide Broadband Subcommittee. Barry, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So first off, I'm guessing that some people might hear this and think, well, you know, people are never happy. They're just grumbling about what feels like slow internet. But put this into perspective for us. In 2016, how important is it to have fast connection speeds?
Well, it's important for most businesses, most farmers these days, certainly most students over third or fourth grade. Most people who have a social life on the internet, gamers, government, there aren't too many institutions that haven't migrated in some way, shape, or form to be dependent on connections to the outside world via the net.
And looking at the variety of download speeds in this report, we've got Kansas, which tops the list at 82 megabits per second. Compare that for us to Wisconsin, where the average speed was 28.59 megabits per second. How much of a difference is that when people are actually using the internet?
Well, it's significant, and we're talking download speed here.
Right.
That's a significant difference. And again, if you're watching something on the internet or you're doing something and you all of a sudden you get this lag or the screen freezes for a second and then you're sort of catching up, that's essentially a speed issue. It's actually even worse than the numbers show on that survey, because the real problem in Wisconsin is upload speeds, which are, the upload speeds are significantly slower than the download speeds in most situations. And so anybody who's using the internet professionally, who wants to, for example, send a large file of a picture or an X-ray or a blueprint or something like that, the upload speeds are significant, and that's where we really lag.
And why are upload speeds and download speeds different?
Because most of the providers of internet are worried about download speeds. The average consumer is mostly downloading. They're watching something. They're receiving a file. They're getting a picture. They're not so much sending as receiving. But as I said, the professionals who are using this really need that upload speed as well. And that's where some of the lags really are. Now, the report is kind of weird because it tries to rank states, and each state is different depending on who the carriers in the state are and how rural the state is. Generally, the more rural the state is, the less average speeds you're going to see on a statewide basis, because you're throwing in people who are essentially still in the dial-up era into that mix. But it also depends very much on who the incumbent carriers are, the AT&Ts, the TDSs, the CenturyLinks, Frontier, Verizon, and so on. Now, Verizon has a product they call Fios, which is a fiber-based product where they run a fiber line into your home. So it's extremely fast, up and down. So states that are Verizon states will generally have faster uploads than other states. We're not a Verizon state. Verizon doesn't have that fiber product. What we're really dependent here on the state in the state are legacy services such as AT&T, which is trying to squeeze all its internet through the last mile, which is copper wire, the same old cable copper wire that you had for phones many years ago. They run fiber to a network, to a neighborhood node or a box somewhere in your neighborhood. And from there, it goes back and squeezes everything into that copper wire. So they originally used that for telephone service, and then they tried to squeeze internet onto it, and in some cases they're squeezing television services onto it. And so as a consequence, the speeds are slow, and they essentially the pipes get clogged. The other in kinds of incumbent carriers in the state that figure into that formula are the cable companies. The cable companies have a slightly more robust system. They have fiber to get into a neighborhood, and then they run coaxial cable, the original cable television cable, into your home. Coaxial cable was essentially originally designed to carry television pictures, television signals. Then they squeeze the internet onto it, and now voice onto it as well. It's a slightly more robust system, but it still is limited. The ideal system, which is what we're trying to explore here in Madison, is a fiber to the premises system, where essentially you have a fiber optic wire, and that's kind of a contradiction in terms. It's a fiber optic cable that goes directly into the home, directly into the business, and it really is significantly faster, both downloading and uploading. So Fios has that. I think Kansas is fast because Google Fiber has a project in Kansas City, and that probably changes the dynamic for the Kansas numbers.
We're talking with Barry Orton, Professor Emeritus of Telecommunications at UW-Madison, talking about why Wisconsin is lagging behind most every other state in internet speeds. And Barry, one of the things that you mentioned as far as comparing different states is that states that have higher rural populations tend to have slower speeds because of the access issues. So I'm guessing that that also means that looking at Wisconsin, the people who are living in urban areas are benefiting from faster speeds than people in living in what is really most of the state.
Right. Again, the cable companies only stopped at the borders of cities and towns. They didn't go into the very rural areas. They might serve a village, but they won't go outside of town because the economics are such you don't run the wire where you don't have enough customers to make the money you're looking to make. Those rural folks had the same kind of lag back in the early part of the last century when it came to electricity and telephones. And it took federal dollars through the Rural Electrification Act in the 1930s to finally bring the electricity and then the telephone wires to the farms of the state. And essentially it was large federal subsidies of rural telephone cooperatives, rural electric companies, rural electric cooperatives, those kinds of organizations that finally brought those wires to the farms, to the very rural areas of the state. What we're looking at now is there are some programs, they're fairly small nationally, that are starting to bring federal dollars into the area of expanding broadband. Back in 2011, Governor Walker turned down $23 million of federal dollars to expand broadband in Wisconsin. So we started from behind, and we've lagged in, even in terms of using federal dollars to do this.
In your opinion, Barry, is there a role that government should play in making sure that citizens, wherever they live, have access to fast internet?
Absolutely. It goes on two levels. First, I think there should be significant. It's essentially infrastructure, and just as like we're going to be investing again, I hope, in roads and bridges, we should also be investing in wires and broadband on a national level. In addition, there are some state laws that essentially make broadband pretty much a marketplace commodity. We deregulated telephone, we deregulated broadband from the State Public Service Commission oversight in general over the last 10 or 15 years. A series of laws essentially said, well, let's leave this to the private sector. So there's a role for government in making sure that internet, and here we're talking really broadband, just like electricity and just like telephone used to be considered, it should be considered like a public utility, something that all citizens should have access to equally and on a reasonable level, and the providers should be regulated accordingly. We've deregulated them here in the state. And again, as I said, we've really depended on the private sector. We took the university out of the internet provision business by law. We took other public entities out. And as I said, we've turned down significant amounts of federal dollars to do this. And so as a consequence of all these things together, government has essentially here in Wisconsin said, well, it's up to the providers in the marketplace. And if they don't provide equivalent service or good service to very rural areas, or in some cases very urban areas, that's because the marketplace doesn't support that. And we feel the marketplace is the ultimate arbiter of this, and I disagree.
We're talking right now about slow internet speeds in Wisconsin and what, if anything, can be done about it. Our guest is Barry Orton, an emeritus professor of telecommunications at UW-Madison.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. How is the connection speed in your part of the state? Do you wish it was faster? Can you get broadband at all? What impact does this have on your work, on your life? And what do you think should be done, if anything, to make a change? Call 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation now about slow internet speeds in Wisconsin. According to a recent report from the technology firm Speed Test, Wisconsin lags behind the rest of the nation when it comes to internet speeds, ranking 49th among states and the District of Columbia. So what's going on?
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Why do you think Wisconsin is lagging behind the rest of the nation when it comes to internet speeds? And what, if anything, should be done about it? That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Barry, meanwhile, here in Madison, an effort is underway to try and create a citywide broadband network. You're chairman of the city's Digital Technology Committee, which is looking into the feasibility of that. What would this project look like if it's successful, and what would it take to put it into place?
Quick correction, I'm chairman of the subcommittee looking at this, of the Digital Technology Committee. And the we're basically looking at the possibility of the city putting essentially dark fiber throughout the city and letting the private sector then connect to individual homes with fiber and do the actual service. So the city would essentially own the large part of the infrastructure, just like it owns the streets and everything else, the water pipes and so on, and then let the private sector serve individual companies, individual subscribers. And we could have one or more private companies doing that. We'd essentially be a partnership. So we just got a study that essentially priced a lot of this out, and it's not cheap. It's about $150 million for the city's portion of this, and then a private company or companies would put in another $50 or $60 million to serve each individual business and household. It's a long-term capital project that might be eligible for some federal dollars next year. We might be one of those shovel-ready infrastructure projects that we're hoping that we see funding coming down the pipe for. But even if we're not, that it's possible that with a private sector partner, we could amortize this, the cost of this over time, and make this affordable for citizens. What this would mean is we would have ubiquitous fiber to every place in the city that wanted it. Mm. And that would mean a real leg up for telecommuters, for professionals who have home-based businesses, for people connected to the university or even non-university people who do large amounts of research or reading online. It certainly would help high school kids, and it certainly would help people who are now in areas that don't have that kind of service, or those that can't afford it. The city could, in fact, subsidize that. And we have a pilot project now that the city is doing in four neighborhoods in the city where we're actually subsidizing an internet service for people in poverty. So the city is going to be facing a fundamental question, and this is the city council will decide this, as to whether the city should get into the internet or the broadband infrastructure business, or it should leave it completely to the private sector as it is now.
Let's go to the phones, and Steve in Milwaukee is up. Hi, Steve.
Yeah, hi. So the reason why I called, they're right next door in Minnesota. We have 25 different communities that just banded together, and they formed a cooperative in order to give themselves higher internet speeds. And so the way that this works, each and every customer for this cooperative that they've formed is a member within the cooperative, which allows them to negotiate their own rates going forward. And actually what they found is that as long as their estimates for demand are accurate, they're going to actually pay lower internet rates than what they're currently paying. It will pay for the project, and I believe it's either 5 or 10 years based on the demand that they anticipate. And they're going to have average speeds of up to 100 times the national average, about 1 gigabit per second. So I heard our guest's idea about dishing Madison's project off to the private sector. I don't like that idea. I think we need to be looking at making this a community-funded effort where the members of the community can actually have a say in what the rates are going forward.
Okay, Steve, we'll leave it there so Barry has a chance to respond. What about that idea?
I think it's a great idea. There are co-ops around the country that are doing this. Again, it's an old model. That's how electricity got to a lot of rural areas. That's how cable television got to Trempealeau County, Wisconsin, through a co-op. A co-op is a great idea, and I'm not against the city doing this on its own. The problem with a city like Madison is to do this well, you really have to gear up to serve the general public with, like a utility does, and it means you need a help desk, and you need people who are willing to come and help people hook up. And I think that can be done, but it's a big stretch for a large city like Madison. It's a smaller stretch to do it in a place that has either an electric utility already on a city basis like Reedsburg.
And in just a minute that we have left, Barry, on a global scale, American internet speeds tend to pale in comparison to many other developed nations. Is this going to hurt us in the coming years economically?
It could. Again, it depends on what kind of fundamental decisions we make as to who controls this and who owns it. At the moment, the American system is based on the existing incumbent carriers, the phone and cable companies, and they serve the general public. Many of the countries where it's much faster, this is being done on a federal level nationally. And I don't think we're going to go that way in the United States.
Well, Barry, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That was Barry Orton, Emeritus Professor of Telecommunications at UW-Madison. He's also the chairman of the Madison Citywide Broadband Subcommittee. He joined us to talk about slow broadband internet speeds in Wisconsin.
I'm Rod Ferret. Coming up on our summer music series set list, we'll feature the Milwaukee rap group Automatic.
First, it's time for our weekly review of state news.